Thank you for the invitation to come and talk to you about what we humble astronomers can possibly contribute to this question of the mass of the neutrino. Correction to my affiliation, I recently moved actually from Cambridge to University College London, where we are establishing a new cosmology group. I thought I'd start by telling you briefly the history of hot dark matter, and then show you how, primarily from galaxy redshift surveys, we can actually set an upper limit on the total mass of the neutrino, that's the sum over the three species, which is roughly between 0.7 to 1.8. That's taking into account different measurements in the literature, which I'll review. So that red bullet is one thing for you to take home, that they seem to be a consensus almost among different authors, that the total, the upper limit is roughly sort of 1 eV. That's the first point. The second red bullet point I want to take home is actually that the cosmic microwave background, for example, WMAP, a beautiful experiment, but nature is not kind enough, and actually it cannot tell us much about the mass of the neutrino, although when combined with the redshift surveys and other probes, it can improve things. So I'll elaborate on these two points, but these are the two main points of my talk. And I'll also speculate about another possibility of getting rid of lambda, having a mixed dark matter, but I'll show the problems with it. What have we got? We looked this week at various neutrino telescopes. So here we use optical telescopes. And this is one large survey called the 2DF Galaxy Redshift Survey of about 250,000 galaxies. Each dot, each blue dot here is a galaxy, luminous galaxy. And this is distance or redshift. And this is direction on the sky. It's done in two parts. And I happen to be a member of this collaboration. There's another major survey called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. I believe Mike Turner, Josh Freeman, who is here, are members of that team. And that's even more ambitious, including imaging of the sky in five colors and generating maps eventually, I think, for something like a million galaxies. So this is a new era in terms of galaxy redshift surveys. A brief history of hot dark matter before I show you how the redshift surveys can actually be used to constrain the mass of the neutrino. I still find it kind of almost intriguing to think that these big, you know, structures on tens and hundreds of megaparsec can actually tell us about the little neutrino. But what's the history here? In the 70s, there was the Russian school of cosmology led by Zeldovich suggested that perhaps the universe is dominated by massive neutrinos. And this led to the concept of hot dark matter. Hot because neutrinos, when they decoupled, were still relativistic and washed out structure on small scales. And as they washed out structure on small scales, that meant, according to Zeldovich, that the first objects to form were big. They were big pancakes, which later fragmented. So it was a beautiful idea. And the good thing at the time of the Cold War is that groups could not talk to each other, which was a good thing because they could remain original and pursue their ideas. But later, it was actually clear that there are some problems with the hot dark matter. And if you like, the sequence of structure formation was wrong. We could actually see in the data that the first bits were formed first, and then they clustered together in a hierarchical fashion. So in sort of the 80s was sort of bad time for the hot dark matter. In the 90s, there was a sort of a suggestion for this hybrid model, primarily by people who didn't like cosmological constants. So they said, well, if we take 80% of cold dark matter, 20% of hot dark matter, we can still have the sort of condition of the flatness of the universe. But again, this encountered also certain problems. And as Mike Turner just described, there's an overwhelming actually evidence these days for a universe which is not terribly aesthetic, I would say, made of different bits and pieces of about 4 26% baryons, 26% cold dark matter, and the rest in the form of cosmological constant or a more complicated form of dark energy, at about 70%. So I think today the soft question we ask is not, is the universe hot dark matter, but rather, is there room to actually add a bit of hot dark matter to this scenario? In fact, all the results I showed when I quoted this of 1 EV scale, very important to remember, it's all analyzed within the framework of Lambda CDM. There's no free lunch here. I mean, we have, it's all done within certain assumptions. This is the model that Mike Tern described in more detail, and I would say probably 95% of cosmologists, you know, 95 out of 100 in a room, typically think that's the model, although it doesn't mean at all it's correct. Flat universe, omega matter of about 0.3, omega lambda of 0.7, omega baryon, H squared of 0.02, Hubble parameter of 0.7, or 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec, age of about 14 giga years, spectral index very close, somewhat below, but probably slightly below 1, and the an amplitude, overall amplitude of the fluctuation, which is labeled according to the fluctuation 8 megaparsec sphere, that's called sigma 8, which is about 0.8, although there is a big scatter. I deliberately don't put arrow bars here, because one of the issues in this subject, which is worth emphasizing, especially for people who are not practitioners, is that we work in a model which we think is sort of standard model, well-defined, but actually the number of free parameters is itself relatively free, right? So you could see some people use, say, 6 parameters, kind of a vanilla-type model. Other people use up to 20, which means that when you fit any data set, you work in a sort of hypercube, and really the errors crucially depend on what you assume on the other parameters, what's called priors in a sort of Bayesian language. And the error bars could easily vary according to it. So it's not just a technical point. It's actually the way we analyze things. Now, the cosmic budget post-WMAP, although it's in a way confirmed what we knew before, is indeed about 4% in baryons, 20-something percent in cold dark matter, and the rest in dark energy. So the question then, is this reality? Or are these kind of epicycles? The history of astronomy, you know that there are models that did work, but they're not particularly elegant. So maybe this hides something deeper. That's beyond me to answer that question. But one can ask a more practical question. Could we add more components to this pie diagram? For example, could we add neutrinos, which, of course, is the topic of this meeting, so it's quite appropriate to ask that question. That's where we stand. The game these days is to add different data sets. This is the density fluctuation, delta over rho, against scale. And we have data from the cosmic microwave background, classes of galaxies, redshift surveys, gravitational lensing, and the intergalactic medium. And perhaps the miracle is that one line, this blue line, goes through almost all the points. One can talk in great length about systematic effects, but it's quite remarkable that it seems it works. And this blue line is the Lambda CDM model. So what I'm going to ask is, could we actually use the redshift survey, which are in this regime, and to slightly alter this blue line by adding a little bit more neutrinos? So this is the question. That's the technique we're using. Before we do that, I also would like to comment, although sometimes we talk about precision cosmology, it's a diagram of this sigma 8, the amplitude of fluctuation again to omega m, and I just want to show that we are far away from just having one point there, right? I mean, there's a fairly large spread, which suggests that probably we can hide other things, like the neutrinos, maybe other components. So now let's zoom in on the redshift surveys. I'll describe in more detail the 2DF, simply because I happen to be involved in it, and together with Oyst and Elgaroy, we actually worked out the neutrino mass from 2DF. So it's a first-hand experience, but I will also refer to the Sloan results and other results. So this is the survey, as I said, nearly 250,000 galaxies. They're all public, so you can go home and calculate yourself, use the data, and find the mass of the neutrino or any other property. We follow the culture of the particle physics these days, and we, as the number of galaxies goes up, so is the number of collaborators. So we're all living now in a new sociology. It's not only a new era of cosmology, also new sociology of working in a large team. And I have to say, on the whole, it's quite, I think, a good experience bringing together theoretician observers. There is even a chance, although not a guarantee, that 30 people read your paper. What's a technology that allows us to actually have such large surveys? It's a technology of multi-fibers. So in the two-degree field, this circle corresponds to 2 degrees on the sky. We can actually place 400 fibers and observe simultaneously 400 spectra, and the same technique is also used by Sloan and other surveys. So that's a breakthrough of technology. What do you do with the data once you have this beautiful map? You can calculate Fourier transform. That's power spectrum. It's the square of the Fourier modes against the wave number. And these are the 2DF data points. They're not independent because they're convolved, if you like. The data are convolved with a relatively nasty window function. It's also done in redshift space. But nevertheless, it's a good fit to the low-density CDM. I should say that power spectrum at a fixed epoch does not measure lambda. It just measures the low-density CDM. And the solid line here is the same model that also fits the other data sets. These two vertical lines are, this is the regime over which we feel comfortable fitting data, fitting models. The reason is, of course, on large scales we have no data, or data is very poor. On small scales we have beautiful data, but then we have to use nonlinear theory. So this is the regime over which we can still use linear theory and use the ab initio spectrum, power spectrum, to infer the, for example, the mass of the neutrino. A comparison between 2DF and Sloan, you can see the data are still a bit noisy, but in one sentence, basically the two are consistent with each other, although done in a very different way. So now, once I describe the observational data, let's just go focus on the neutrinos. First, the number of species is quite important because it affects the rate of expansion of the universe. And for example, it could affect the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Therefore, one can actually use the Big Bang nucleosynthesis to constrain the number of species. And these rough numbers I found in the literature, it's actually surprisingly quite broad, and it's actually on the lower side of 3. That's 95% confidence level. However, at this meeting, at this for the rest of the talk, I shall actually use 3, although there are some papers in the literature which talk about a different number of neutrinos. And also, I assume no annihilation and talk to John Bicom, who is here, about other scenarios. Perhaps a nice little equation here relates the omega in neutrinos, so it's the density in neutrinos divided by the critical density times the Hubble constant squared, can be written as the sum of mass of neutrinos divided by 94 eV. So this gives you the connection between the microphysics here and the cosmology. And please do notice that it involves h squared, although we think we know it, it's still there. What's the physical effect? That's not new. This was discussed by Zeldovich and his co-workers back then. It's the effect of free streaming. Neutrinos were relativistic when they decoupled the washed out structure on scales which are typically in that range of about 10 to the minus 2 or so in terms of wave number. And it turns out, so what you see here are different lines. This is the power spectrum, that's amplitude, which we usually label as sigma 8. K to the n is the primordial spectrum, so n equals 1 is the Harrison-Zeldovich. And this is the transfer function, which is a solution of Boltzmann's equations, putting together photons, dark matter, baryons, and, for example, neutrinos. And that's the effect of suppression. As we increase omega nu, there's more suppression. And that's the effect we're trying to measure by looking at present-day redshift surveys. Okay? It turns out that the suppression factor is actually proportional to the ratio of omega in neutrino to omega m. That's an important point. So it's not as if we look at a redshift survey and we read on the sky the mass of the neutrino. What we measure is the ratio of omega neutrino to omega m. And then if we know omega m well, we can say something about omega neutrino. Together with Øystein Elgeroy, a former who did his PhD in nuclear physics and then came to Cambridge as a postdoc, and he's now faculty in Oslo, we looked in detail at what the neutrinos can do on this 2DF data set. So this is, again, the power spectrum against the wave number. As I said, points are correlated, but we have a covariance matrix and all the rest, so all the statistics is done properly, we believe. And what we basically find, I mentioned that what we constrain is the ratio of omega nu to omega m. We find that it's actually less than about 13%. Again, I told you that we work in a hyperparameter space. We had to freeze certain parameters. I'll say something about it in a minute. If you marginalize over an acceptable range in omega m, for example, using other probes, such as supernovae, this translates into an upper limit on the mass of the neutrino of about 2 eV. So this is our number, essentially. It's about 2 eV. I showed you the little equation that can translate, take you from omega nu to from m nu to omega nu. So that corresponds to an upper limit of about 4%, interestingly enough, comparable to the baryon, omega in baryon. And that's what sort of the minimal model you'll get from oscillations, which of course constrain differences between squares of masses. But if you take a minimal model, that's what you get. And I believe, Mike, have I counted the zeros correctly there? So it's 0.001. Thank you. If that's true, you know, we have a four-component universe. Not the first time in the history of mankind to think about a four-component universe. But it's quite remarkable, really, that these big scales, the tens and hundreds of megaparsecs, actually tell us about something so fundamental. I have to say it was a pleasant surprise coming from the more observational side, where neutrino was not on our, you know, research observing proposals for 2DF. Nobody thought about it. It came as a spin-off when we started hearing about the results from this, from you and others about oscillations. So it's one example that some of you start an observational project and only later on you discover it's useful, so something completely different. This is a kind of an interesting diagram which shows the total mass of the neutrino, what I labeled as capital M sub nu before. And here are the masses of each of the eigenstates, M1 and M2, M3. And this is done by taking the observational empirical values from the solar and atmospheric oscillations. So no need to tell to this audience how to do it. Obviously, you have the numbers, but you have two equations which relate the squares, the difference between squares of masses. So it leaves you this freedom to make these diagrams. What's interesting here is that the tritium beta decay is there. And our 2DF result is somewhat better. You know, it's not a competition. I mean, I'm not trying to stand with a flag and say cosmology is better. But at the moment, as far as we can tell, cosmology gives better limits on the absolute mass of the neutrinos than the tritium decay. But I wish you all the best. I wish, you know, maybe 2 years from now to see this line down there. And the same with the neutrinoless beta decay. It would be very nice to see it. Then if you add to 2DF the WMAP results, you can improve it by a factor of 2 or 3. And that's if you just take the oscillations at some minimal model. The other interesting point is really that you can really only measure remove the degeneracy between M1, M2, M3, only if we go below about 1 eV or so. So we have really an interesting challenge here on both fronts to push things towards sort of 0.1 eV. This, I think, would make things very, very interesting. I mentioned this parameter degeneracy. That's obviously, you know, a crucial issue because we work within a certain parameter space. I just want to show if we change the spectral index from 0.9 to 1.1, for example, things do change, but not that much. It's actually surprising how robust the result is. And likewise, if we change omega matter, you can see that omega nu to omega m does vary, but it's still within the sort of limits of about 2 eV. There's another problem. The power spectrum we measure is not the power spectrum of the mass. It's the power spectrum of the galaxies, the luminous galaxies. We don't have yet the ultimate theory for explaining the way galaxies form. Obviously, there's a large community out there working just on that, but there isn't yet a textbook solution. So we talk about galaxy biasing, the fact that perhaps galaxies only formed at the peak of the distribution, the mass distribution. So how do I know? I tell you I measured the mass of the neutrino, but I really used the power spectrum of galaxies, not of the mass. So this could be a major systematic effect. We tried to actually look into this by using the state-of-the-art semi-analytic models that tell us to what extent the galaxy power spectrum can deviate from the matter power spectrum. And this is this bias parameter, which is, could be a function. So we allowed it to be a function, and that's what you get. Of course, if you allow it to be anything, you can see, I'm sorry, the labels aren't so clear, but you can see very large correlation between the biasing slope A and the neutrino mass. So, you know, if the light of the galaxies doesn't know where the mass is, everything I showed you should be taken with a grain of salt. But luckily, these models suggest that the variation is not that big, and the connection between the two is almost just a constant. And I think it gives us some confidence. In this paper, we actually looked in more detail at the effects of biasing and also of nonlinearities. Moving to the CMB, so the question is, you know, we got the redshift surveys, we have a number, 2 eV, could we do better? Great progress in this field, no need to tell you, from 65 to 2003. And this is WMAP result in full glory, the spherical harmonics against L. First, second, third peaks, and so on. And that's their table of numbers. And for this audience, what's probably relevant is this line for, where is it? Here. So here's their upper limit on the mass of the neutrino translated into the mass per flavor, right? So you should take this number multiplied by 3 to compare it with my number of 1.8 eV. They would get 0.69. So I have to say, WMAP is a beautiful experiment. They've done a wonderful job on both, on everything. But it's actually incorrect to say the WMAP neutrino mass, because actually CMB itself is not sensitive to the massive neutrinos. So this table I showed you is what they get when they combine WMAP with 2DF and also with another data set of Lyman alpha clouds. But it's mainly the 2DF which affects it. So this result is actually the 2DF result. But why does it look so much better? Why does it look almost three times better? It's because they can constrain much better omega m. So what I told you before is redshift surveys like 2DF and Sloan constrains the ratio omega nu to omega m. If I have a method of telling omega m better, I can improve the mass of the neutrino. So that's what WMAP does. I just wanted to clarify it because it's a bit hidden in the papers. And even in this meeting, I saw WMAP neutrino mass equals, you know, it's actually from 2DF. There is another somewhat intriguing result with colleagues of mine in Cambridge, young colleagues of mine in Cambridge, especially Steve Allen, used a sample of X-ray galaxy cluster. That's a point made by Fukugita a while ago, where he noted that, you know, we can actually look at the counts of clusters, how many clusters at a given temperature luminosity. And it tells us about the small scales. And then we have the CMB. So there is good leverage there, which, if you like, indirectly tells us about the shape of the power spectrum. That's a simple way of understanding what's going on there. So what Allen et al. Have done is a fairly elaborate analysis using these X-ray clusters. Now, they use a particular relation between the luminosity of a cluster, which is what you measure in the mass of a cluster. Now, that's non-trivial at all, okay? Because the theory can only tell us about the mass function. That's easy. That's called the Preschecker formalism. But how to go from what you measure in light, in X-ray light of a cluster, and relate to the mass, seen here, for example, in lensing, that's a question, right? But they came with this rather somewhat provocative claim that what they find is not just an upper limit, they actually measure the mass of the neutrino. And that's their number. I probably prefer to phrase it slightly differently by saying that it really illustrates the strong degeneracy between the amplitude fluctuations and the neutrino mass. Their amplitude turns out to be lower than what some other people get, for example, WMAP. And therefore, it gives a larger neutrino mass. So there's a coupling between the two. So if I want to take a more cautious point of view, and I have to say the data set is very nice and the analysis is very thorough, but I would take a more cautious point of view and perhaps constrain the combination of the amplitude and neutrino mass rather than claiming an actual mass. So that's where we stand. If you allow me one more provocative approach, so I take the blame for that, that's in this paper with Elgaroy. We try to actually go back to the mixed dark matter, which I said people like George Primack and others advocated in the 80s. And it's quite intriguing because actually if you try, it's not even a best fit, we just tried it. A universe with no lambda at all, no cosmological constant, omega m of 1, omega nu of 0.2, you can also still feed the 2DF data. So this is the 2DF power spectrum. Blue line is the standard cold dark matter, which is dead now. But you can see the green line is the lambda CDM, most people like, and the red one is the mixed dark matter. And, you know, the lambda CDM is slightly better, but not by much. And you can live with it. Why can you live with it? Because I told you before, what the redshift surface measures is the ratio of omega nu to omega m. I showed you we got an upper limit of 0.13, so we can still live with 0.2 divided by 1. However, there is a heavy price to pay of a Hubble parameter of 45 compared with the standard Friedman et al. 72. So then it depends how many enemies you wish to acquire by pushing a model like this. Because it's in problems with the HST, H-naught, it's in problems with supernova, problem with cluster evolution and baryon fraction. But it's still intriguing. It's intriguing that actually, as much as we work on these redshift surveys, there's still a room for something else, and unless you make assumptions about the Hubble constant. With the CMB, actually, it doesn't work that easily. You have to work a bit harder, and actually there was a parallel paper the same time we did this work, Blanchard et al., came up with a paper where they, again, managed their motivation. They had a strong ideology there of actually getting rid of lambda, and they managed to do so by actually introducing a break into the primordial power spectrum. So to actually get the CMB to fit this model, you need to play with the power spectrum as well. So it's a heavy price, but I bring it because I think, if anything, what this field needs these days are some alternative models. And now the Cold War is over, so we don't have... You know, everybody agrees with everything. I think we need more arguments. This brings me to the summary. What I've done here, I actually looked at the very recent literature. You see, the game really only started over the past 2 years, stimulated by your work on the oscillations. So this is our result from 2DF alone. And as I mentioned, this is an upper limit of 2EV. I emphasize again, all these results are within the lambda CDM paradigm. We take that model and we add the neutrino. So it's 2EV here. Spergel et al., as I mentioned, reduced it by a significant factor down to 0.7. But it's quite, and I mentioned it's not the WMAP that does it, it's just the WMAP constraints omega m. So indirectly, it helps you with the mass of the neutrino. Interesting enough, the Tegmark et al. Result, which is Sloan plus WMAP, which you would think would agree with this one, it actually is more similar to what we got from 2DF alone. Now, you have to be careful. I said be careful which priors were assumed. But one reason is this biasing, because the WMAP team actually fixed the biasing using another method of bispectrum, while in what we have done, and also Tegmark, was to marginalize over the amplitude. So you can see easily, just by different sets of assumptions about the amplitudes, you can easily get factor of 2. I want to sort of highlight the achievement using this technique of redshift surveys, but I actually want to be quite clear about potential systematics there. And this is yet another paper where they've done WMAP plus 2DF plus Sloan, grand unification, and they got about 1 EV. I think in the big picture, again, and I try to show you what can go wrong, right, not to oversell it. So although we are the winners at the moment, compared with your experiments, you know, there's still room for improvement there. I think there is this issue of the parameter degeneracy, this is the issue of understanding biasing and nonlinearities, but nevertheless, it's quite impressive. If you think about all the things that go into this analysis, the fact that we end up with the 1 EV number is very impressive and non-trivial. And when I heard your talks using your experiments and I could see limits of that order, I think it's impressive. We have to pause for a minute and say, wow, this is maybe close to the truth. I also mentioned this claim for detection, subject to the caveats. And let me summarize then. I showed how the big galaxy redshift surveys, which were really designed to do all sorts of other things, tests of other cosmological parameters and galaxy formation turn out to be a very useful tool for actually constraining domesticity of the neutrino. In fact, I had this reference before, but I should mention, give credit to a paper by Hu Eisenstein and Tegmark, who pointed out before the surveys were actually complete. The bottom line is we have an upper limit, which is around 1 eV, and there's uncertainty of about factor of 2 due to various effects, astrophysical effects I mentioned. It's, again, I emphasize, it's within the lambda CDM paradigm, and it's subject to priors. Maybe there are some alternatives, such as mixed dark matter, but then you have problems with other probes. But again, I strongly encourage coming up with alternative models. What's the future? There are a number of papers in the literature already. It's clear that our challenge on the astronomy side is to go down to the errors of about 0.1 eV. That's a challenge, right? Because that's when things are getting interesting and the comparison with your experiments are getting more interesting. So there are papers in the literature which talks about using Sloan and Planck and reaching that limit. You know, there's a different range of optimism in the papers, so I have to read them carefully. And there's also this technique of weak gravitational lensing of either the background galaxies or the CMB. Interesting enough, all these papers claim in the abstract error of about 0.1 eV. Let's hope they're right. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much for this presentation. I'm sure that there are questions, please.
In the mixed dark matter, you said that H is 0.45. Mm-hmm. Now, observers claim H is 0.7, I mean, data. So what do you do about that?
Well, as I said, it's in disagreement with the results from Seyfried, de Friedman et al. And that's one of the problems of this proposal for mixed dark matter. Having said that, if you look at the literature, a while ago, there were papers by Alan Sandage who claimed Hubble parameter of 45. So, we have to remember that all these relations, including Cepheids, are empirical. There might be a different method one day which may give different numbers. I think we have to keep an open mind.
One difference, which I don't believe you did mention, between the Allen analysis and the standard WMAP Sloan analysis is the use of sigma 8 as a measure of structure compared to the Lyman alpha forest. Can you comment on the reliability of those two and how that affects the neutrino mass that you derive?
Yeah, I mentioned the strong coupling, because there is a degeneracy between the overall amplitude sigma 8 and the neutrino mass, which in a way I think is what Allen et al. See, if I phrase it in a more conservative way. So if I was given an absolutely precise sigma 8, would be wonderful, yeah? But we haven't got it. So there is a plot diagram I showed at the very beginning. Maybe if there's a bit of time, I can try to go back to it, which in a way summarizes, that's in a post-WMAP paper commentary we submitted to Science. So this is sigma 8 and omega m. I would say that in this game of cosmological parameters, these are the least accurate parameters. And it's not only sigma 8 is related to the neutrino mass, or coupled with the neutrino mass, also coupled with omega m. In cluster counts, if you like, the X-ray counts is only one variant of this. There's a whole literature out there of doing cluster abundance in different techniques, using temperature, using lensing, and so on. You can see a widespread, and this arrow shows systematic uncertainties. Same is true with lensing shear. And also, the same is true with the Lyman alpha, right? The Lyman alpha clouds are a beautiful probe because they go out to very high redshift, but there is still some discussion in the literature to what extent they are faithful tracers of the mass distribution. So whatever we do, I think, you know, we do the best we could as astronomers to utilize all these tests, but at the end, there's astrophysics hidden there, whether it's with the clusters, Lyman alpha galaxies. We try to minimize it by modeling it, but it could also be the case that one day we'll use the parameters and actually learn more about astrophysics than about cosmology.
Maybe one short question. Oh, there are two. I see. Okay. Sorry.
The 2DF results seem to show some wiggles. Would you like to comment on them?
Oh, it's very intriguing. I knew somebody who was sitting in the first row will ask that question. Probably people at the back couldn't see the wiggles, but... How much time have I got to answer that question? I think everybody wants to go to coffee. But it seems to be an audience that likes a bit of provocation, so here it is. This is the, you know, solid line is sort of the best fit, but it's only one possible fit. There are these wiggles here, which bothered us back then. And if you look at the Percival paper, our team paper, you'll see a discussion of this. And there's actually another likelihood peak, which corresponds to a large baryonic fraction, which could generate that wiggle. Having said that, we have to take into account the fact that we observe the power spectrum through a window, which tends to couple modes. So it's amplified by that. And there's also so-called sort of cosmic variance, right? We only have one chunk of the universe. And what we need is just more chunks of the universe. We need larger surveys. So we can see whether it repeats itself. But as you asked, there is a plot which bothers me. This is a plot for Tegmark et al. This is showing our 2DF result in blue, the Sloan result in black, and another survey, IRAS, in green. And actually, to my eyes, there is some correlation there between these peaks. But I don't know. When I talk to the authors of this paper, and also to my own colleagues in 2DF, people tend to be more cautious. So I think maybe it's something for those who like peaks and those of you who remember the broadest peaks in the galaxy distribution, maybe it's something to look into.
So thank you very much for this. I'm sure that there's a lot of interesting questions.